Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
So this episode is brought to you by NorthPass Business. Against small businesses and startups, they often work with limited resources and reduce costs wherever possible. While this is sometimes practical, cybersecurity is one area where you don't want to cut corners. Creating strong, unique passwords for your company's accounts is a surefire way to defend your business from data breaches. However, with the number of personal and work logins we use daily, it's very easy to get password fatigue, leading to reusing the same passwords across accounts. So NordPass Business is a powerful password manager for organizations that removes the difficulty of generating and remembering strong passwords for you and your colleagues. Additionally, it allows for you to integrate single sign-on with your company's Google Workspace accounts and effortlessly create groups to share sensitive information across teams and projects. So see NordPass Business in action now with a 3-month free trial by going to nordpass.com/Panthera and use the code Panthera. This episode is brought to you by Basecamp. So Basecamp is a project management and team communication application that has been around for about 18 years, and it's used by thousands of companies today. Basecamp is all about simplicity. It is designed to give you and your team the tools you need to get work done. They have message boards, to-dos, file storage, chat, calendar, and much more. Basecamp is built to help you in getting out of your way and let you focus on what matters. Again, you know, like when you're adding a bunch of people, there's a bunch of files that need to be shared. You need to be effective. And that's where Basecamp comes in. They actually are from the guys that brought to you 37 Signals. And really, they help in making decisions simple and also effective. So go to Basecamp. Their pricing is simple, and they give you the all really the features in a single plan. No upsells, no upgrades. Go to basecamp.com/dealmakers and try Basecamp for free. No credit card required and cancel at any time. Thank you, Basecamp, for sponsoring this episode. Alrighty, hello everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So we have a very exciting founder today. You know, we're going to be talking about both sides of the table. You know, on the operator side, on the investor side. You know, we're going to be talking about building, scaling, you know, financing, all the above, all the good stuff that we like to hear. And I think that you're all going to find, you know, the story of this founder very inspiring. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Nikita Shamgunov. Welcome to the show.
Excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
So Nikita, so let's do a little of a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up in Russia?
That was a lot of fun, actually. And if I look back the events of my childhood, the memorable ones were kind of the Berlin Wall came down. And that was in the news, right? I was not in Berlin, obviously. I was in Russia and in a relatively small city called Yekaterinburg. But that was definitely hit the news. And then, not that event, but time-wise, after that, a lot of things started happening. You know, the fall of Soviet Union, the hyperinflation in the early 90s, and then just kind of a very, very quick transformation from what used to be Soviet Union and planned economy and Iron Curtain to opening up of the country to the world. And that was felt both scary and exciting. You know, I was very young at the time, and so my parents kind of, I would say, sheltered me from the harsher realities of things, you know, of the economy and hyperinflation and whatnot. But it was certainly a brand new world that we were experiencing in, and I'd say my generation took the full advantage of it. One thing is that was there, and it's a similar phenomenon for that of what I read in this book, Freakonomics. Was at my high school, and I went to an elite math high school that's called SUNS, whatever that means, which I think stands for Special Scientific and Research Center, something like that. In that high school, our teachers were university professors, and looking back, I realized that the reason we had those folks. And they were relatively young. They would be like assistant professors, you know, today They were all in their like mid, late 20s, or maybe early 30s. The reason we had them is because they needed to moonlight. They needed to have their ends meet. And they would go into a good high school with a lot of talented kids and teach them more math, teach them computer science, teach them science. And that set the foundation of my early education and interest. And there was a lot of passion towards math during those days. Both my dad and my granddad are mathematicians. And at that time, I thought I'd be a mathematician too. The brand new and exciting world of computer science started to kind of pull me into that universe. And eventually that became my life.
I mean, obviously, you know, computer science, you know, was what ended up taking its course. But in your case, you know, like when you moved to St. Petersburg for the PhD, you know, there was like a very interesting shift, you know, there that happened. And that got you to land into Microsoft. So what happened there?
My interest in computer science kind of manifested in the desire to participate in programming competitions. And I started that in high school. I was mildly successful. I, you know, never made it into the country level or international level. But I continued at it at the university. And there was a programming competition, which still exists. It's called ACM ICPC, which I started to participate in and eventually made it into the world stage. We went to, I think it was Netherlands. And then another time we went to Vancouver, Canada, and got to a bronze medal. So that interest in programming competitions eventually what pulled me into the computer science program. So I did my bachelor's in math and master's in computer science. And the best school in computer science was in St. Petersburg. That is a university in fine mechanics, computer science, fine mechanics, and optics. And it's still one of the top schools in Russia. So just kind of staying on that programming competition train and refusing to grow up, I guess, I went ahead and joined that school for the PhD program and moved from Yekaterinburg to St. Petersburg. I was doing PhD and working full time to support myself. And some of the folks at that company joined Microsoft. I was referred there. And post-graduation, I packed my bags, which I had won, and moved to Redmond to work for Microsoft.
So when you were working at Microsoft, you know, obviously the idea of going back to school came about, you know, business school. But when you actually executed on that, you know, you land on business school and you quit the same day. I mean, that's kind of like a little bit of aggressive there, Nikita. What happened?
That was a funny story. So I was... at the time, I think it was like about 4 years, I worked for a very, very capable team inside Microsoft called Microsoft SQL Server. That's where I truly understood how to build systems and complex systems and databases. I started to get a little bit restless and trying to figure out what is next for me. And then I was like, oh, business school. That sounds interesting. Potentially, you know, people who are good at computer science but have no idea about business, that's what they do. So I applied and passed all this like exams, which I think was SAT and whatnot. And then I joined the business school. I was super excited. I walked in the first day, and my thesis was that I'm going to meet some very, very capable people who are business leaders, and I will learn a bunch from them. In addition to, you know, from the program. But as we were going around the table and sharing our experiences, I realized that the folks were kind of lost. And then I realized that about myself as well. So I was probably lost as well in that moment. So I quit the first day. And at the time, I already had a Facebook offer. So I took that offer and flew down to California. I basically changed my thesis. My thesis became, I'm going to move to the Silicon Valley, where the mindset and the entrepreneurial spirit is high, and then I'll meet people that I'll be more inspired about, and then eventually maybe we'll start a company.
And actually, you know, like that's what ended up happening. You know, one thing that you found there was that the culture of Facebook was completely different to the culture of Microsoft. So why was that the case? And what would you say, you know, were the sequences of events that really led you to end up, you know, starting your first business? Because, I mean, there were like certain things there that got you to start reading essays from Paul Graham and Y Combinator and things like that. So what were the sequence of events there that needed to happen?
Yeah, Paul Graham was already famous. I started reading his essays at Microsoft, but the gravity of that personality and the gravity of Y Combinator wasn't really fully understood while I was in Seattle. As I moved down, I realized that Facebook was wildly different from Microsoft. Just the pace of everything that was happening, like the clock speed was of the company itself, was a lot higher. Facebook was in the hypergrowth mode. I believe I was either engineering employee 800 or there was a total employee 100 of 800. And the company was growing rapidly. It felt like stuff just flying around, people picking it up, getting it done. And that was definitely the move fast, break things era. The mindset of the people that walked in through the door, and Facebook was onboarding everybody in batches, that was called bootcamp, was also very, very different from what I see at Microsoft. And especially in such an established team as SQL Server, where the pace is slow, the throughput is okay because the team's bigger, but the product is established and whatnot. Here, lots of new things, lots of focus on building rather than maintaining and whatnot. And that's where I met my co-founder, with whom we applied to Y Combinator. Through that, I understood a little better what Y Combinator really was. We met Paul Graham, and then we had a tough choice. Do we want to leave Facebook and all this early stock, which was already apparent how valuable that was, or we should stay at Facebook and realize that stock, or should we leave Facebook and start a company? And we were already inside the Y Combinator. We got accepted. We walk in with Facebook badges, and Paul Graham is looking at us and saying, "Well, you got to get rid of that." And so we did. And so that was a tough call, but I think it was the right call.
So what happened next?
So then it was a lot of grind. I lived in the office. Eric lived across from the office. That was just an apartment in San Francisco, right across Costco, 10th and Harrison. We stayed there a while until we started to build our testing infrastructure, bought a bunch of servers. They were loud, they were hot, so it was impossible to live in the office anymore. It was a lot of, we have all this like glamorous views sometimes of what startup building is like, and potentially Facebook, the social network movie, may give you the wrong idea. But what it looked like is a bunch of folks would sit down in front of their computer and headphones and write code, day in and day out, hours and hours through the day. I think we did a lot of things right, and I think we got a few things wrong. I think, long story short, MemSQL, that was the company that became SingleStore, is now a unicorn company. It makes close to $100 million in revenue, I believe, and growing really fast. It's on the trajectory to go public. There's all these billboards and 101. The timing of that is uncertain because nobody's going public right now, but it certainly is getting to a position to do so.
And what ended up being the business model of MemSQL? How does the company make money?
Yeah, that's really what's so interesting. And now that I'm in venture, I'm thinking about those things a lot, because whatever model you choose, and I'll explain what the model of MemSQL kind of is and was, comes with a particular territory and a particular way of generating business. Single store, we renamed MemSQL to Single Store because over time it was not longer in memory and it was not longer just SQL. So we were just basically, our name was misrepresenting what we were, and so we changed it to Single Store. The business model is it's an enterprise focused company with average sales price in the high tens, low hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And it finds its customers by establishing what is called an enterprise marketing, which is a combination of ad spend and account-based marketing and attending enterprise events, collecting small number of high quality leads, pushing those leads through the process, through the funnel, and that revenue comes on the other end of it. And so you end up, depending on the efficiency of this enterprise account acquisition, the revenue scales with big step increments, right? Because every deal is like, I don't know, $100,000 to $100,000, and especially the expanse could be very material. But it also comes with the high customer acquisition cost and relatively long sales cycles. So you don't need a lot of those deals to build a significant business, but those deals are hard to get. And it takes a lot of energy and then push of the company to keep growing at a high pace.
Got it. Now, in this case, you know, for the company, how much capital that you guys raise in total?
I need to check, but it's in the 300s, you know, 300 millions range. And especially the later rounds are all $100 million plus. They are what is called like mezzanine rounds. It's the round that you get mostly to fund your sales and marketing, to keep the growth. And the bigger your base is, right, the harder it is to grow, because now if you want to grow to 100%, now you need to add, you know, it took all that time for you to get to 100 million. And now if you want to keep growing at very high pace, like, you now only have a year to add another $100 million. So it's an expensive proposition, but that's what the name of the game is, to building a high quality enterprise business.
Now for you, you know, as part of this journey, you know, you started as the CTO and then you eventually transitioned to the CEO role. I mean, that's not an easy thing. And in fact, you know, many, you know, great CTOs, they're not good, you know, when it comes to the business side of things. So how was that, you know, transition period for you and how hard it was?
So now that I'm kind of having a broader visibility of other companies, I tend to agree. The CTO to CEO transition is rare. And in fact, product to CEO or marketing to CEO or sales to CEO, I kind of see more of that. Sometimes general manager to CEO, general manager trained by a bigger company, obviously. I see those transitions much more frequently than the CTO to CEO transition. Depending on the circumstances of why you might want to have this decision. So let's, that could be different for a particular CTO that sees it as the next step. The mechanics were the following. I had to make sure that my product and engineering team are absolutely intact and humming. And that required me to have leaders that run product and engineering. And then I forced myself to shift my focus completely to go to market. So basically trust that the product and engineering are working very well, and trust the leaders. And of course, you interact with them very, very frequently. But despite the fact that the core skill set is in the product and engineering, basically shift the focus into go to market and go to market completely. At that time, there were, you know, there were two major problems in front of MentEqual. One was, well, we didn't have that much cash in the bank, so we needed to raise cash. And you raise cash because you grow. And if your growth slows down, then raising becomes really, really hard. So we're in that situation where, you know, we had time to demonstrate that growth, but it wasn't a lot of time. And the specific thing that I did is, and that's like a hack, is to go to your existing customers and ask for more money. And obviously, for those that you have relationships with, you might feel a little scared, but at the time that was the right answer. And so I did, and they gave me the money, and they didn't even think that hard. And so that was kind of a revelation. So we were either potentially undercharging, or the other revelation is that if you have a good relationship with your customer, then they will give you money if you ask. So that was cool. That was learning, and that allowed us to demonstrate almost 100% growth in a year, and we raised a round from Google. So that was one, and that's how we solved the money problem. And the second business problem that was in front of me was that the that the whole business was transitioning into SaaS and cloud. And MemSQL at the time was a hybrid offering. You know, it had a on-prem offering and a cloud offering. And the checks for the on-prem offerings were higher than the checks for the cloud offering. But it was clear, it was already clear at the time that that's where it's heading. It's heading to the cloud, to all managed offerings. And so now looking back, it's like, okay, of course, like who cares about on-prem? Nobody cares about on-prem. Everybody cares about cloud. So that transition turned out to be harder than I thought. I thought it was, oh, it's just code or it's just technology. But turns out having a SaaS company is an architectural change, both in the product, but also in the DNA of your company. You know, in one world, you don't have DevOps. In the new world, you have DevOps and SREs. In one world, you care about, installation, and then you support that installation with your sales engineers. In the other world, that is given. You push a button and you get it. And so the composition of your company is different. And you start with your management team. One of the books, and I was voraciously reading at the time, one of the great books I read was Only Paranoid Survived by Andy Grove, where Intel was going from memory to CPU. And Andy was coming into his management team, looking around the table and realizing that he doesn't have software people on the staff team. And then once the decision of going hard off the CPU was made, he had to change his management team. And then such people changes are always hard, right? Because, you know, somebody could be, you know, in that case was a hardware, you know, memory expert, and the new DNA should be software expert. And you need to forge new partnerships with software companies. And before that, you had to forge partnerships with hardware companies. So in very, very similar process when you transition your company from on-prem into the cloud. Your partnerships are different. Your team DNA is different. Your staff team has to be different. And it took longer. It took single store longer than I thought. I thought it would be like a quick 1 year transition, but it took years. Today, single store is decisively a cloud SaaS company. But again, it took a long time to get there.
So we'll get back to our conversation in a minute. But if you're an entrepreneur or a sales leader, you want to listen to this. Let me tell you about Wingman. Not Tom Cruise. Wingman is a conversation intelligence tool that helps folks like you coach and scale up their sales teams really fast, really easy. Now, I know you know scaling is not just about hiring. Getting the team up to speed can be the real speed bump. Well, Wingman can help you in getting that. It lets you build call libraries with game tapes relevant to every sales situation, complete with highlights and notes, and it's asynchronous. I mean, repeatable sales training engine. Not just that, Wingman even helps during sales calls with contextual battle cards and monologue alerts. The great thing about Wingman is that it plays nice with all your existing tools like Salesforce, HubSpot, Zoom, Teams, and Google. It even syncs up with Slack so you don't have to log into your CRM all the time for deal updates. So head over to trywingman.com to give it a try. That is trywingman.com. It's just the Wingman your sales needs to really predictably beat revenue targets quarter after quarter. This episode is brought to you by Partner Hero, which provides customer service outsourcing that's built for the needs of scaling and high-growth startups. They offer flexible terms, fast onboarding, and the ability to scale teams quickly, perfect for fast-growing businesses. I mean, let's face it, you know, you're all startups. You know, it's time for you to really stop trying to do absolutely everything. You need to get yourself out of the support inbox so you can actually focus on growing your business. So again, Partner Hero is flexible. They have quality assurance. They have offices around the world to really provide that help and support that you need. And if you're ready to bring in outside customer support help for your startup that feels like it's part of your existing team, then check out Partner Hero. Head over to partnerhero.com/dealmakers. to book a free consultation with their solutions team and mention that you heard about Partner Hero from Dealmakers and they'll waive the setup fee. Now, obviously, it sounds like you were doing the right things because, I mean, you took the company from $7 million to $40 million But at what point, I mean, things were working out the way that you, you know, had hoped for. So at what point do you realize, hey, you know, maybe it's time to take a look at what's next, and how do you end up landing on the other side of the table as an investor?
Yeah, great question. So at some point, I hired a co-CEO at Singlestore, and I was looking for president to run go-to-market. So I spent a good amount of time nerding on go-to-market and driving the revenue up. And then I realized I also need a go-to-market partner. And I was looking for president, but ended up hiring a co-CEO and a great leader, Raj Verma. So we partnered up, and then I shifted my focus back. So from go-to-market back to product and engineering. And in there, I realized that I also need to bring a new leader and brought a chief product officer. So that was the first time in my in 10 years that my calendar emptied up. And of course, as a founder, I knew that, you know, it's only a matter of time. It is like start creeping back up. And as a founder, there's so many things that you can do that are high leverage to your business. But it also had been almost 10 years by then, 9 years. And I was craving to get to a certain amount of breadth. Because when you build a company, you're looking at the world through the keyhole of and what everything that's surrounding you is your company and your team and whatnot. Your team obviously gives you a ton of leverage, but you're missing on the breadth because basically it's your technology, your ecosystem, your customers, and your competition. So, and you live in this world day in and day out. Versus my thesis was that as you go into venture, you will see much the world from a much broader angle. And you see a wider set of technologies and you'll have an opportunity to learn some of them deeply. And that's certainly delivered. Vinod funded MemSQL and Khosla Ventures was instrumental through the CTO to CEO transition and basically getting the company into the next rounds of funding. And through that, the relationship got stronger and stronger and stronger. So Vinod invited me to the table. So I decided to join Khosla Ventures as a partner.
So obviously here you are now, you know, in Khosla, and you know it's a different angle, right, on the way that you're seeing things. And I'm sure that you've had the opportunity to learn a lot, you know, because you've had, you know, a bunch of investments, you know, about 8 investments that you've done. But I guess now, you know, that you are in Khosla, how do you think about categories and then also category winners? You know, I'm sure that, you know, you've been able to really have an insight, you know, into a court side ticket, you know, on what it looks like, you know, when it comes to pattern recognition.
Yeah, definitely. There's many ways, and that's the beauty of a venture. There are so many ways to look at the world. And one of those ways is splitting, and I'm on the enterprise team, basically working with founders, with enterprise founders, with a lot of kind of business to business or business to developer, or B2C to B type companies. The way to look at this world is you can split it into categories. And so in like database category, there are operational databases and then there are analytical databases or data warehouses. And in each category, there are typically 1, 2, 3, 4 category winners. And in the modern day and age, the number of real winners is like 1 or 2 in every category. And if you squint at the world and you start seeing it, not necessarily just in enterprise software, but everywhere, you start seeing, you know, 1 or 2 winners in every category. And then either a lot of nothingness or like a long tail of products and companies that don't each make a ton of money. And in software, that's even more pronounced than in the real world. You know, in the real world, it's like, you know, Pepsi-Cola and Coca-Cola, right? And Coca-Cola is like 50%. Pepsi-Cola is another 25%. And then it's like a long tail of stuff, but none of them is gigantic. But in software, it's worse. In software, there's a winner, there's an Uber, there's a Lyft, and then there's just nothing. There's iPhone, there's Android, and then there's nothing. And so what this means for venture, and there are particular reasons for this dynamic in the technology world. And that reason is mostly because of the incremental cost of an extra copy of software or service is zero, right? And so once someone is winning, they can suck all the oxygen out of the category and kind of completely proliferate and dominate the category. And there is a book that's called Play Bigger about creating new categories that talks about the dynamics in category definition and in category domination by technological products and companies. And so once you take that lens on the world, the question is, you know, is it a category leader? And is there an opportunity to become a category leader? Always comes in. And usually every now and then, there's also a technology wave that is coming in and sweeping through all the categories and giving, you know, our world, the world of entrepreneurs, an opportunity to redo things from scratch. And previously, that world was cloud. Previously, that world was mobile. Previously, that world was social. And then, you know, previously, that world was like the internet. And then again, periodically, either a new category gets created, cloud or mobile or whatever, and it comes either a certain technology or innovation or disruption that really gives you an opportunity to change the architecture of each category. And once you change the architecture, it's a new product can be built. And if I think what's kind of exciting is there's always something like this technology platform transitions. And we're in the dawn of the next one, which is AI and large language models, which I think will architecturally change a whole, basically every category. Each incumbent either takes advantage of this or will be disrupted by something that puts this AI capabilities in the center of the product. So that's super exciting.
Now, in your case, you know, you're now at Khosla. But you're also, you know, working, you know, on Neon, right? So how does the idea of Neon come about? And I mean, obviously, in this case, it's a little bit different to single store because rather than starting, you incubated, you know, Neon, you know, as part of, you know, the Khosla, you know, endeavor that you're taking on and that you've taken on. And how did that come about? I mean, it's a little bit different of a journey here, you know, incubating and bringing it to launch. So tell us about this.
Yeah, starting incubating is different. And obviously, I had an opportunity to do either here. One of the competitors for single story is Snowflake. And Snowflake was an incubation from a firm, from a venture firm called Sutter Hill Ventures, and this particular individual called Mike Spicer. And through that competition, I learned, and obviously Snowflake is much bigger than SingleStore. Through that competition, I learned about some of the incubation playbooks, obviously observing from the outside in. But recently, I actually met Mike and we sat down and we had a conversation about incubations as well. So there is a particular playbook. If you go online and Google Mike Spicer incubation playbook, you will find some information about it. And the shiniest incubation out of Sutter Hill is Snowflake. I actually thought about this idea and this company, incubation or starting, doesn't matter, for about 5 to 7 years, at least five. And I was finding myself in a similar place as, Tony Fadell, as he was thinking about building Nest Thermostat, but he was busy. He was busy building iPod and then iPhone. So obviously Tony was on the journey of changing the world with Apple. But he had this idea about the Nest thermostat on the back of his head, and he was hoping that somebody will go and build it, but no one did. And so with Neon, I was in a similar boat. I was thinking about, oh, you know, unlike this enterprise focus of single store and chasing scale out workloads, like big scale workloads, which bring a lot of dollars, but there are not as many of them. Can we build a developer first technology that people start building their applications with? And I couldn't build it at single store because it just didn't make sense for single store to do that. The architecture of the product and the company was already set. And with Neon, it's another database company, but the architecture of the product but also the architecture of how it goes after after its users is very, very different. And it was, you know, again, it was impossible to change that at single store. So I walked in into Coastline and said, Vinod, we should incubate this. And Vinod is like, yeah, you know, what do you need? And just a few months later, I put together first a slide deck, then a team. The difference between starting and incubating is when you incubate, you can really engineer your founding team. And in the process of that engineering of the founding team, you have the power of the venture firm behind you. And that comes down to recruiting. That comes down to continuous debate about, you know, should we do A versus B versus C and how. And you also have a brand behind you. So engineering the company DNA, and Vinod likes to say that the team you build is the company you build, not the other way, was our kind of joint effort and joint endeavor in the beginning, in the early, very, very early stages of the company. In return, Coastal Ventures has an unfair ownership compared to all the other funders into the company. And that's what the trade-off of the incubation versus starting is. Since Neon raised $54 million, you know, Coastal put five initially, and now the company has raised $54 million from, you know, Coastal, Founders Fund, Alad Gill, General Catalyst, and GGV, and each one of those investors, and a long tail of angels as well. And each one of those investors is fantastic and bringing a lot to the table. But again, the original kind of hatching the company and, you know, engineering the company DNA was happening here at Coastal Ventures.
So Nikita, imagine you go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of Neon is fully realized. What does that world look like?
First, every app in the world needs a database. And it's a no-brainer and no-regret move to create that database on Neon. And so what is Neon? Neon is serverless Postgres. Postgres is that, you know, very popular database technology that existed for many, many years that is incredibly popular in developers. And outside of the top five databases in the world, Postgres is the only one that's growing. So everybody else is shrinking their mind share and market share. So MySQL, Oracle, SQL Server, those are the top three, then Postgres, then Mongo. Out of the top five, only Postgres is growing. And Postgres doesn't have a home. Like, there's no company that's behind Postgres. It's kind of like Linux. It's a truly community-led effort. As a matter of fact, it's even more decentralized than Linux. So Linux has Linus, and Postgres has a group of committers that are decentralized, and, you know, they're making decisions of what goes in and what goes out. And the developer experience is what makes that a no-regret move to take your, when you need a database, to go and create one on Neon. And that's a combination of how easy it is, what the economics are, how cheap it is. Well, not necessarily cheap, but like how economical it is, how convenient it is, and how reliable and robust it is. You also might be thinking, you know, we had Git as a source control system, but it is an absolutely no-regret move to put your Git repo on GitHub right now, right? And so this is what we're building. We're building a GitHub-like both experience, convenience, and kind of economics of putting your Postgres workloads on Neon. And it has been doing very, very well. Not only we raised $54 million in 16 months, but, you know, raising this much money is only possible if you're demonstrating traction. So there's already 11,500 as of today databases on the platform. It's growing rapidly. Lots of partners are coming on board. So unlike single store, we're having this kind of groundswell coming in. There's a big question how much money we'll be able to generate. But we have so much cash and so much growth, so we can stay in that state for a long time to just kind of proliferate around the world. Again, driving towards that kind of GitHub-like vision of becoming the default platform for Postgres workloads to start, but then for every database workloads in the future.
Nice. Now, obviously here we're talking about the future. So now I want to talk about the past and learning from it. So if you were to go into a time machine and let's go, you know, bring you back in time, you know, perhaps to that moment that, you know, you were thinking about starting this. If you could go back and give yourself, I mean, starting single store, sorry, your previous company, if you could go back and give that younger self a piece of advice for launching a business, what would that be and why, given what you know now?
I think the hardest lesson of single store was building hybrids versus building the future. So I think that, you know, eventually we found ourselves realizing that the business is in the cloud and the hybrid and the on-prem part of the business is more of a liability than an asset. But we had to treat it as an asset because most of the revenue was there. And that transition is a really, really tough transition. You will either stay forever hybrid, and that's the right thing to do. But in technology, it rarely is. Once the technology gears shift, you find yourself in this like absolutely new world. And so you don't want to find yourself selling pagers in the age of iPhones. And in every category there, you have your own pagers and you have your own iPhones. And it means something different for every category and for every product that you're building. I mean, the biggest realization is to build new and build the future. Be uncompromised on the purity of what you're building. You may get the future wrong. You may get the timing wrong. But if you want to succeed in a very, very big way, you got to build the future. And kind of only the future, and the rest will kind of you know, pull yourself if you got the future right, and if you execute, you know, kind of relentlessly. If you do that, you're not wasting time in various hybrid architectures, and you're not building transitional technology. You're building the future technology. You're building Teslas. You're not building Priuses in a way. And numerous examples I can name where this approach is the right approach. And because the world is so big, there are counterexamples for that as well. I think it's a lot more fun to build the future too.
Yeah, no kidding. Now, for the people that are listening, you know, that want to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
So Nikita at coastlaventures.com, as well as Nikita at neon.tech are the best ways to get me. I'm also on Twitter. Yeah, I'm also on Twitter. So do follow me on Twitter. DM me on Twitter. DMs are open.
And what's the handle on Twitter?
Nikita Base. So it's like a combination of my name and the recognition that I spent the last 15 years building databases.
Love it. So Nikita, thank you so, so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us. Thank you.
Really happy to be here. Thank you for great questions.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.